This is the February 20 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk with our panelists, Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing and Kurt Kimmel of AgMarket.net about the marketplace. And then we'll hear a very special conversation that I held with Jerry Gulke of the Gulke Group. We talked at length about the marketplace. You want to visit our website to hear all of that at willag.org, where, by the way, you can sign up today for the All Day Ag Outlook. It's coming up at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana on Tuesday, the 4th day of March. The Farm Doc team will be there. We'll have six commodity analysts, including Sue Martin, on hand with us. And we'll hear from John Reed, too. He's the director of the Center for Digital Agriculture on campus. Spent 20 years with John Deere. We're going to talk with him about autonomous operations on your farm. We'll do that on the 4th day of March at the Beef House. The cost is $40. Register today at willag.org. Now, let's begin our conversation with Dave Chatterton and Kurt Kimmel. Dave Chatterton, let's begin with you today. When you take a look at the marketplace as a whole, corn, soybeans, and wheat, how do you suppose the fundamentals domestically line up? And then do they differ very much on the global stage?
Yeah, Todd, it's a really interesting question. I think they do a little bit. And right now we're in the U.S., we're looking at a situation where you have a very kind of corn versus bean situation shaping up here. And as we look forward here, when we look at our corn ending stocks in the U.S., not overly tight, but certainly, not burdensome at this point, where beans are going the other way. When you put that in terms of where we're at in the world carryout for soybeans this year, looking to set a new record high with record production in South America, pretty much assured at this particular point. When you look at the global, carryout situation or the world situation on corn and the ending stocks there, and particularly when you break it down to the exporters of corn around the world, so the U.S., Ukraine, Argentina, Brazil, those stocks and those stocks to use ratios are almost as tight as we've seen. I mean, historically, they're at a stocks to use ratio that gets you down to a where you just do not have a lot of room for error. And there is the fundamental tie into the marketplace. Funds have been long corn. They've been buying. We've rallied more than a dollar since the late summer low. And in doing so, we've seen the fund position explode, not to a record high, but certainly to a level that gets your attention here. And, that's been reflected as the outside capital has come into our marketplace here. We've had a good exchange with the farmer, but we're now at a point where farmer sales have caught up. And so, if that flow continues to come, it's favored corn to this point, but we've seen it start to get dispersed into the other grains as well, into wheat and into the soybean complex. So soybeans are very much tied, I think, on the upside to what corn can do for them. Corn here is in a situation where until we can assure that we've got a good safrinha corn crop on the way in Brazil, and until we've got the acres that the market is asking for in the U.S. here this spring, so somewhere between 3 and 5 million additional corn acres, that maybe there's not a lot of downside here. So that's the fundamental tie-in. I think it's more bullish in corn when you look out, particularly on the world stage, than what we find in the U.S. and the opposite in beans.
You used a word that we'll hear later too, bullish in corn. Do you have upside potential or targets that you're using?
Well, I mean, we're at a level here where a lot of people thought, maybe including myself for a while, we would never get $5 on the spot. And, we've got the summer contracts above that level. We're still not there on the new crop. But those are numbers that all of a sudden bring profitability back into play. We've certainly done ourselves some favors here in terms of where we're going to end up on the February spring crop insurance price guarantee. It's going to actually be probably above where it was last year by a little bit. Again, something that we didn't think would happen. So I think the bullish element becomes, if we get through that upside, our recent highs, or if you go back, into December, that 508 level, 505 level, we've been very close to that, but we haven't been able to push through it. If you do push through that, you're looking at a market that goes at least to 525 and more likely 540 if you can get the funds to come in and start trailing behind it and buy.
Kurt Kimmel, Dave's talking about some numbers that farmers really want to hear. He used the word bullish. We'll hear Jerry Gulke use that a bit later in the program. Are we three for three with you?
Well, as far as wanting to hear something on new crop, yes, but old crop, a lot of old crops have been sold. So, yeah, if we're going to keep marching higher here, there's some replacement strategies to be on board. As far as the old crop march, we're watching this 5.508. 5.08 was the May high before we started rolling down into the growing season. Then plus May at 5.08, that's about 62% back up to the contract high. New crop December corn, our next price target is 4.90. But there's just a ton of moving parts out there. Yes, you can be bullish corn. But yet, too, we got to remember, we don't export a whole lot of corn percentage-wise is beans, but our best customers are Canada and Mexico. And if these tariffs would happen to really get going in through here and we make our trading partners mad, you know, that could put a little bit of a dim light on exports, even ethanol into Canada. A large percentage of our ethanol exports go into Canada. So there's a lot of moving parts out there. When you look at the optimism here, we're in the opinion, come in and put some price floors in case this thing does not giddy up and go here.
So tell me about the domestic fundamentals in that case, as you view them, because we have now a carryout at 1.55, 10% stocks to use ratio. How much difference does it make that we are at what most agricultural economists would call the midpoints, relatively speaking, for the marketplace, that 10% stocks to use ratio, that is, as opposed to what's happening on the global marketplace?
When you look at domestically, feed usage is high, even though feed usage is a miscellaneous category. We're feeding at heavier weights, so that continues to be the big consumption here. The other parts of ethanol, they've been trying to downplay ethanol, but ethanol continues to hang in there. So domestic consumption is the key to the corn market. But if you go back in May when we started looking at the current supply-demand balance sheet, carryout was 2.2, 2.1. Then all of a sudden here this late fall, early winter, we're down to 1.5. There's some ideas maybe we could be as tight as 1.4. So it's significantly tighter than where we started from last May. Now, when you project out to the new crop, the 25, if the larger acres keep demand the same, they're going to start talking 2.2 for this new crop, possibly. But if this demand stays good and we run into some weather, watch out.
Who are the buyers on the world market that we can depend on at this time? Who are we looking to buy? Is China in the marketplace? Does the trade issues that come along with tariffs change who might be in our mix?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. And for a big part of that reason, China is really not in our marketplace, and they're doing really all they can to avoid it. If you look at how much corn they've taken, and that's not just a U.S. thing, that's a global thing, but it's been next to nothing. And I think they continue to do that. If you look at the amount of beans they've booked out of South America, primarily with Brazil, but now testing the Argentine beans for their reserves, which is something that historically has been reserved for the U.S., you know, they're making that move. I think when you bring it a little closer to home and you look at Canada and Mexico, as Kurt mentioned, Mexico, our number one, you know, destination for export corn, they've booked 40% of our overall corn sales for the year, and they're a number one target for the Trump. You look at other countries like Colombia is the number four buyer. Trump also had to go around with them. We're picking on Canada, and as Kurt mentioned, they're the number one importer of U.S. ethanol and in a very strong demand. So when we look at what's happened, low prices did their job, Todd. I think they stimulated demand. They did it in a different way in terms of it's not all been about China, or at least it's not been about China directly with the U.S., but we've been able to replace some of those customers, and particularly on the corn side of the equation. How that's going to change going forward, I mean, we've seen countries like Colombia, Mexico, China willing to at least engage with Trump regarding, you know, a trade deal or regarding these tariffs, and in a way that looks like or gives you the impression that, hey, we can see a deal get worked out longer term. When you look at China, I think you're very much at the other end of the spectrum. They're doing things that indicate they're not willing to negotiate, or at least not in the short run. And I think, you know, you put the simple math to that, 10% additional premiums on their imports versus, you know, having to comply with the remainder of the phase one trade deal, or as was rumored today, enter a new trade phase one type trade deal, this year, it's probably cheaper for them to take the 10% tariff right now. If those tariffs go up, maybe that math changes. But I think China's playing the long game. And so we're seeing a little bit of a rearrangement of those export players on the demand side.
And so there are a couple of things that happened this week with China, relatively speaking. One of them, the Trump administration made an official name change within the government forays of for China, now calling it China instead of the PRC or the People's Republic of China. And then Taiwan, which we have had a one nation policy with, belonging to China, but an independent area from it. Taiwan decided that they wanted to be a buyer of U.S. agricultural products. How much difference do you think that both of those things can make?
Well, as far as Taiwan being a buyer, they've been a buyer in the past. They just need to, you know, be a little bit more of a buyer. You know, we've got plenty of supply to ship that way. But as far as China goes, one thing is, there's ideas we could go back to phase one. They'll come back and purchase that. I don't think so. I don't think China's going to budge. I think China's got plenty of supplies right now. I think China's got a good export system to the southern hemisphere right now. So I really don't know if we're going to see a whole lot of headway with negotiations with China. I think they're just testing the water in through here. And hopefully they can try to work something out, but it'd be interesting to see how this all unfolds.
Turn your attention now to the soybean market. Bit of a different creature as opposed to corn. Soybean, as we go through this February crop insurance setting month, much lower than last year. You can talk some about that. And it remains burdensome, and we still have a supply coming out of Brazil. Not quite yet, just beginning, really. And it'll come to the marketplace in April, May, June, July, probably August.
Yeah, I think the best way to say that is the export window for U.S. soybeans is pretty much closed or is closing very, very quickly here as we go forward. And that part of that is China's not been a direct buyer, and part of that is the availability of the South American crop, which right now out of Brazil is priced anywhere from $65 to more than a dollar cheaper than the U.S., depending on where you look. The soybean balance sheet on its own is not, you know, not overly burdensome, but it's certainly not bullish. But if you look at the corn relationship to beans and on the ratio, you're seeing an old crop at, you know, 2.1 or 2.05 to 1 and new crop maybe in that 2.2 handle. So it's a situation where beans just haven't wanted to get a lot cheaper versus corn than those metrics. And in doing so, it goes back to the comment I made earlier where I think the upside in beans is actually tied here to corn and what corn may or may not be able to do. Now, we may get some help next week or at the end of next week with the USDA's outlook for them. And there's, you know, whisper rumors of a 95 million, you know, acre plus number in corn, which takes your bean number down to a point where you're 81.5 million acres. And all of a sudden you've got a bean balance sheet for a new crop that starts to look a little bit tight or look a little bit concerning. And the market is a forward looking mechanism. It's a futures market. And that will be something that's in play. Now that's a what if from the USDA, and we'll have to see where they go with, you know, in the May report when we get the first look at new crop acreage. But, you know, there's a number there, but the bean market, I think, very much tied to the corn market at the moment, Todd.
Yeah, the corn-bean ratio is probably going to get even a little bit tighter yet, but the enthusiasm or the outlook's new crop, as Dave mentioned, we're going to see some higher corn acres. You know, we're looking at the southeast, cotton and rice maybe switching to corn, but two, there's a situation where milo or sorghum exports are non-eventful. China's not buying any of that, so there's guys in Kansas switching to corn. So, you know, that first glance here next week's okay, but the actual March 31st is going to be quite the event.
What should producers, you think, do about soybean sales? Not old crop, but new crop, because I don't know, they're probably looking at a loss at this time.
Which is the least lost? I guess beans is the greater loss right now. But yeah, basically, we're targeting Well, 1050 was first benchmark, 1105 in new crops our next target there. But the simplest thing to do is put a price floor under you and leave the upside open. That way, if the weather guys are right, which a lot of them are leaning towards some weather problems here this growing season, we have some up and through here, would you be able to sell higher. But you take less bean acres and lower that yield a little bit, it could tighten up the supply-demand balance sheet.
Yeah, Todd, I think you need to be, you know, we're in a situation where a lot of the old crop beans have been marketed at this point. For new crop, we're sitting 15 to 20% sold and tapping the brakes just a little bit. That's not to say fall asleep at the switch by any means, because you need to be paying attention here. But if corn has bought itself a little bit of time to see how things develop in South America and see how the acreage situation looks in the U.S. this spring, that's probably supportive to beans. Does that mean that we're able to sell beans later in the year at a higher value? I don't know, but I think we have the opportunity to maybe wait just a little bit. So definitely more proactive on getting bean sales off sooner rather than later versus what I would say in corn. But for right now, like I said, that corn bean tied to us indicates that we're going to be just a little bit patient. If we get that move over 11 and you get 1120 or 1140, I think that changes pretty quickly. But to your point here, locking in a value right now that's below the cost of production for many producers, probably just something that we're a little reluctant to do here in the near term.
And finally, as we wrap up some of our time here, could you consider what the marketplace looked like in August, September, and October, and how a dollar rally developed within the corn market when most marketers, farmers, analysts alike, really did not see that coming? The first indication that it might really be different, I suppose, came from farmers talking about, you know, harvest a little bit, but it was the November crop and crop report that really changed things some.
Yeah, Todd, I think that's a pretty easy and glaring answer. And if you look at what the USDA did between the November and the January reports, typically you throw December out of that process, but they, from a supply side standpoint, they made a record reduction in yield, a record reduction in production in terms of beans on that report. They did a very similar thing. I think the second biggest reduction that we'd ever seen in the November report, the Nov-Jan combined report for corn, and really adjusted the amount of available supply that analysts like myself and like Kurt were looking at, and all of a sudden changed the thesis. So that's what I think got the attention of the funds. You know, we're at a point now where we're past that January report. We're considered, you know, final production from the USDA, and what can really change now or what's going to affect it is either foreign production and or demand items here in the U.S. And that's what the USDA has left in their arsenal to change or to play with. The supply situation isn't going to change much, and the USDA, by making those adjustments and doing it in a record way, really kind of changed the narrative of the marketplace, and I think got the attention when the inflation play was ignited following the Trump election. Corn had a story and beans had a little bit of a story, and that's where we've seen the money flow come in.
Yeah, we actually were empty going into this fall. I mean, I don't know if the grain stocks report's right or not, but a lot of elevators cleaned out. And so the end user buyer was eager to buy, and they bought, and they bought, and they bought. And a lot of these end users are covered out to 60 days, and they want to stay 60-day coverage. So they were there buying it, and as Dave mentioned there, the report shed a little light on the adverse growing conditions in the northern part of the Corn Belt, and all of a sudden you had you know, smaller production numbers, and here we go in through here. So as we move forward, it's kind of a gift in a way here. Hopefully we can keep the momentum going here and get out of the red on new crop profitability.
So at this point, it is important, really important, to understand what the demand side of the marketplace looks like and how it might change the balance sheet for old crop, because we simply won't know a new crop balance sheet until May from USDA.
Yeah, and I think there's two things there, Todd. One is that's a, you know, 100% true statement, and you throw the tariff and the Trump factor into that, and it becomes even more unclear in predicting what may or may not develop on that front next, and what sticks and what doesn't, and how long it sticks for is, you know, I won't call it a fool's errand, but it's nearly impossible. So what we know today is that demand is really overperformed. If you look at U.S. corn and you've got, you know, as Kurt said, let's say 17% as exports, we'll call the other, you know, 37% in ethanol, 38% in feed, all have overperformed here to date. Will the tariff situation and some front, you know, loaded buying slow that down in the back half of the year? We'll have to see. But I think the risk right now from the numbers that we have in hand is that corn demand goes higher and the balance sheet tightens further. Similar, but less so in the beans.
Yeah, we could be front loaded here, particularly Mexico. And the key now from here on out is actually shipments. Now, we got till end of August, but we need to watch the shipments, make sure we shipped what we sold in through here. But we've got a year with Mexico. Mexico really doesn't have any other source of corn in a sense. If you look at the drought monitor, it only shows the U.S. You got to get the full picture of Mexico. They're still dark red and they're going to continue to need corn. But the problem is, long term, is if they figure out another way to source their country of corn from the southern hemisphere, we're in deep doo-doo.
Final word from each of you. Before we get to Jerry Golke, who will join us in just a minute, I talked to him separately for our Commodity Week program this week. Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing, your final word.
Yeah, Todd, I think, you know, we've kind of covered it all. I think, like I said, we're patient doesn't mean, you know, bury your head in the sand. It means be paying attention here and look for your opportunity. I think this is a year with the amount of geopolitical risk in the marketplace here. And let's just say everything goes right in Brazil. Everything goes right with our safrinha crop. We have a good crop here in the U.S. Definitely going to be looking at price pressure here through the spring and summer. So make sure you're paying attention right now here in the near term. Keep in mind, you've got less than a month to go to lock in your crop insurance. March 15th is the deadline for that. They've extended the ARC PLC deadline to April 15th this year, but make sure you're talking and looking at where we're at. As we mentioned, you know, corn, you know, spring price guarantee about a dime above last year here at the moment, beans more than a dollar below. So, you know, keep that in your metrics here and make sure you're planning from that front as well here. Use that first step towards, you know, towards a safety net here for your production.
And Kirk Kimmel from agmarket.net, your final word.
Making farming great again. Don will bring it on, but as Dave hinted on there, there's just a lot of moving parts out there. There's a lot can happen. I believe volatility is going to increase here as we move forward. Actually, you look at new crop corn, we could be as high as 6, 6.50 with weather concerns, or we could be down to 3.50 if these tariffs get. And that's a wide range. I don't think we're going to be in this range, but I think we're going to be one or the other.
Kurt Kimmel and Dave Chatterton joined us on our Commodity Week program. I also spoke with Jerry Golke of the Golke Group. Here's that conversation. Jerry Golke now joins us from the Golke Group. He and I have had a discussion since, I don't know, October, I suppose, some online, some email, some in person, Jerry, about this marketplace, particularly in the last 2 months. You have turned really friendly to what I would say might be bullish, this corn market, probably all of the markets, I think. Can you tell me the reasons why?
Well, you know, but you can go back to, excuse me, last August 30th when we really had a moment of truth where, and we were involved in that, where we either had to pay our elevator 20-some cents up front to store grain, or if we had grain in storage, open storage after harvest, we had to sell it of old crop corn. And so that made some people make a decision that says, I'm not going to pay the 25 cents a bushel and store it. So that a lot of grain got sold. And then, of course, the media was pretty much intact, is saying, well, any kind of a rally we get, you know, $4.50 should stop it, $4 should stop it. Any 10-cent rally, you need to get some corn sold up here because we haven't seen this price in a while. And we do some technical analysis and some computer-generated things that are kind of like AI, but we don't publish it, you know, formally. But give us a buy signal that, and as part of the gap higher in corn, we'll start with corn, that gapped higher when we went from September to December when you looked at a continuous chart, and that was because of the carry in the market. Last year, we did not earn the carry. The market was gone down for the last 2.5 years. This year, I looked at it, and I said, you know, this is going to be a year different than last year. We'll probably earn the carry this year. This is the year I should have probably paid 25 cents a bushel to store the grain till till I plant the next crop, you know, in the ground in May of 2025 or something. But we bought some back on the futures. But that was the first indication. And when something goes down so long and it gaps higher, that means that suddenly somebody who had been selling corn for the past few days and weeks suddenly becomes an owner of that same corn. They wanted to buy it. And you ask yourself, what happened that would make someone who was selling corn for so long suddenly want to become the owner of the same stuff they didn't want to own 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, or whatever? And we saw corn take off. And then I looked at the charts and I said, you know, for the last 2.5 years, oddly enough, our highs have been in October, November when we harvested the crop, and then we never went higher after that. So if we could ever take out the October, November highs, we might be onto something. And we did that in December, and December actually closed at the high of the month. In December, we haven't seen something like that for a long time. Corn closed at the high to end the year, and then January it opened and went higher from there. Versus last year on January 2nd, we gapped lower and went south. And never rallied up to fill that gap again all through the whole crop year of 2024-25. And so that kind of alerted us to it. And then we have some technical things that tell us if nothing else, it tells us, I may not want to go long here, but I don't want to be selling grain any longer until that system turns. And I've used that since 1982, and it's worked fabulously. I paid for the farm using that because it keeps a person honest. You know, if you have an idea in mind, you have to look at yourself and say, at some point in time, I might be wrong. What's going to tell me that I'm wrong? And use some parameters to do that. And when we close above the previous month's high, that tells you something, because that market digests weekly reports, a WASDE report. And in January, that's a pretty good report in January 12th or 11th that tells us. And now all of a sudden, we're going above that level and making new highs for 2025 as we're going along. And the market is acting as if, well, a while back, and eventually, you know, I preached that sermon on I'm going to be wrong one day and we're going to see the top. But it's told us quite some time ago that this is a bull market that very few people see. And I made that comment on Top Producer and DTN. I said, you know, most people that I listen to on TV and radio and read wouldn't recognize a bull market if they saw it walking down the street. And that's pretty arrogant or pretty politically incorrect to say that, but that has become a fulfilling prophecy for me to see that. And then I say, when the masses start to see that, oh yeah, well, you know, these tariffs aren't so bad, and look what happened 2 days ago or 3 days ago. Thailand came out and said they were going to proactively buy grain from the U.S. to circumvent any problem with the tariff, to make things more equal, and not buy from the people they used to buy from, whether that be Brazil or whomever. So we have that scenario coming around that's a positive for tariffs, and it just keeps feeding on itself. And they say that, you know, a bull market needs to eat every day, and I've heard that on radio for a long time, and you got to take advantage of this because any minute now the spec is going to sell. And all summer, last summer, we talked about, when is the spec going to get out of his short positions? He got out when the last dog was left town, probably. And now he can stay long for a long time. We've got the speculator, large spec buying, and we've got index funds buying as well. And of course, it's scenarios, well, they can't stay long forever. Well, it's been my experience, they'll stay long the market until every hedger out there has been blown out, and then they'll finally start selling. So that's kind of it in a short story and a long version, but there's an awful lot of things that have happened along the way that were signals that, you know, I always used an analysis. If something isn't doing what it's supposed to do, I got to reanalyze my thinking, or what am I missing, that the market is going up day after day after day and week after week, and the corn has, especially new crop corn too. What's going on that I'm missing? And then you have to take a reevaluation of something, and selling a little bit here and there is never wrong, perhaps on an up market. But buying puts to put a floor under things has been very expensive, and been my experience that in a bull market, I've done that in the past. I paid my dues. I bought puts and I rolled them up, bought puts and rolled them up. And pretty soon, about the time I needed the money to buy the final put when the top was out, I was out of money, or I was mad at my broker or mad at somebody because I'd been throwing this money trying to put a floor under things. It works. You spend a dime to make 15 cents, but it's ill-gotten money that if you don't have a good outlook, you may get yourself caught in that. And that's that's kind of what I've seen happening along the way. And it's encouraging because I think there's been a paradigm shift in agriculture to a different way of thinking that's going to take some time for a lot of people to realize what's happened. And by that time, the ship has half sailed.
So just to be clear, you and I were talking last fall. I have soybean crop only from last year to market, and I have a corn crop to market this year. And we were just talking after the fact. You and I had both made sales, I think. I don't remember.
About, I sold everything out of the combine.
Yep. Yeah, out of the combine. I did not sell everything off of the combine. I did finish my marketing for soybeans too early. I did that in late December for what had been gone to the elevator, a mistake on my part, both for sending it to the elevator and second for marketing too early. However, in this last month again, that's when you really turned bullish. What technical signal did you see there? I understand the gap higher, the October experience where you had the monthly closes higher. Why do you suppose this market will continue to climb after moving a dollar to the positive side?
Well, you look at it, and I sent you some charts. You look at a monthly chart on corn and wheat and even soybeans, we're a long way from where we were 2 years ago. Now, there was a reason why we were there. There was hype about the war and problems in Brazil and so forth. But I think this one is, if you're looking for a fundamental reason, it's if you look at the stocks and global stocks, and I think some of your guests have talked about it, the global stocks of wheat are very tight, the lowest globally ex-China. If you take China out of the equation, corn and wheat are the lowest stocks they've been, stocks to use ratio or the lowest absolute stocks that we've had left over in the world in what, 10 years, some of them 13 years. So you've got a situation there where, if people want to make nice and get along, and if you think about it, a lot of people are worried about the tariffs, but Trump's only got, less than 4 years left. In 4 years, he's gone. So you make nice for a while, and you try to appease things so you don't screw things up too bad with the United States. And we're a big dog in a big pond, so some of the people will listen. If four or five or six or ten small countries start to buy something from grain from us, and Trump has said the European Union is not buying much grain from us. They don't even buy our cars. And I just had a guest here that traveled to Europe recently, and I said, how many American cars do you see in Germany? He said, none. I said, how many Mercedes do you see in Illinois and California here? He said, a lot of them. And I said, there lies the rub. So if you're bugging Europe about, you don't buy any of our grain. Well, you buy a little bit of grain, and then and it doesn't take much. When we're talking 1.5 carry or 1.53, I think we're 100 million too short in exports already. And that fundamental fact was that each of the last two or three years, our exports have increased over the previous year, which 2 years ago, that was an easy task because we weren't selling much. Then we increased it. Now we're increasing it again another 20%, and even in beans. We're selling grain without China. And I wrote a number of articles for Top Producer about the big gorilla in the room. We got to get rid of that big gorilla and rely more on smaller, more countries buying from us and domestically improving our domestic demand through biodiesel and all that stuff that we're trying to do. So if a few of these people do that, countries do that, all of a sudden you got to carry out probably about 1.5 or maybe 1.45. And that looks to be now carrying it out into 2025-26 as well, because you've got three, four more years left of the Trump administration. And do we really think that if he gets people to buy grain from us, that next year they're going to say, well, we're not buying any more from you. We kissed your feet at State and Main, and we're not doing any more. No, they're going to continue to do that to make doggone sure he doesn't pull something on them again. Right or wrong, we got to live with that environment. And that's pretty bullish for agriculture. And so what you were looking for, what changed my mind technically? Well, there's an old saying, if you close above the previous week's high, especially in a week that has an important event that happens that could affect your bottom line, you have to take notice and say and ask yourself, what do I know now that I didn't know a week ago? Or what is the people buying and I'm selling into this market? What do they know that I don't know that they didn't know 2 weeks ago? On a monthly basis, anytime you close above the previous month's high, you gotta be concerned. And especially starting a new year, if January is better than December, And February is better than January, and we're seeing that now. And we got a lot of commodities out there that are about to make new highs for 2025. That's serious consideration. That if you're bearish, you gotta have a moment where you come and reevaluate yourself and say, what did I do wrong? And I tell the guys that work for me in the brokerage business and analysts, my son-in-law Jamie, I said, we gotta constantly look behind us and say, what's coming up behind us, of which we know not what, that's making the price of this grain go higher. And if I'm so smart and want to sell a 10-cent rally, why am I wrong 20 cents later? What did I miss? And then you start to look for things. And, of course, with the experience that I've had for decades, I've paid my dues. I've learned the hard way to not ignore some of those things. And we're seeing that now. And I think the question lies now, are we going to get it by enough acres of corn to make it so that when the end users look at this thing and they say, okay, you got 4 more million acres of corn, or 4.5, looks like you're going to have a carryover 1.9 again. That takes the pressure off the upside. But for right now, you got to be concerned that we carry in a 1.4. Now what? You know, we got to have a pretty doggone good crop on whatever acres we produce to meet the demand that we're, call it artificial or browbeating or whatever you want to call it, Trump has said a couple of different times in the last week even, I think farmers are going to be happy with what happens with the tariffs. And so he owes us something for putting him in the office, and I think he's going to help pay up for that. And, of course, technically, you know, you have all kinds of things. You have moving averages, and we do some things on our computer that we don't publicize. We use them ourselves because I don't want to educate the competition, so to speak. But that help. I mean, you just don't ignore things. When things give you a buy signal, whatever parameters you use, whether you're whomever, you have to have some kind of a parameter that says, what is it that's going to happen to make me wrong? I don't mind being wrong small, but I don't want to be wrong big. And being wrong big was selling a number, say, $4.40 $4 corn or $4.50 corn. Now we're at $5. If you're at that level, you have to sell that. You sell that and you say, what? I don't want to leave all that money on the table that may be coming down the road a ways, because marketing is both ways. It's selling on the way down and buying on the way up, and buying in a bull market is very difficult. It's very, even though I feel we probably have a lot more to go. And we were discussing it today. We have a little corn that we have about a 20 cent loss in it, when we were saying, well, you sell something here and hope you're wrong. Well, now you're wrong, and you're wrong by 20 cents. And now what do you do at $5? Is just this the beginning? Or do I take a $1,000 hit per contract and say, I don't want to be short here because the upside looks like it's just now opening higher? It's not as easy as you can talk about it, but pulling the trigger is two different things. So all that I'm saying is that you have to have an outlook before you can make some kind of projection. And just breaking even or setting, you know, even setting targets for, I go through my P&L statement of what I should plant, what I shouldn't plant. The market doesn't care if I'm going to make money or not. I'm trying to maximize my profit at whatever my cost is. I'm going to farm whether I like it or not, because I've got the land. It's going to be planted to something, and I need to maximize those profits, not minimize my losses by selling my first load at break even. I can go to McDonald's and make $20 an hour and more than break even. I get insurance for that. That's not the reason I got into farming 50 years ago, is to break even. So without an outlook, you have to know your risk and reward, and that the charts really help you with that. And charts are nothing more than money flow that tells, where's the money going? Where's the money? Where's the guy putting his money that's responsible for $1 billion worth of investments in an index fund? He makes Jerry Gahlke look like spit in the wind. And so he's got a lot more at risk. So you have to digest his, what does he know that I don't, that makes him smarter than me, that he's long the market and he bought my grain when I was selling it, or me, or whoever else it is. So there's just a lot to marketing that is not just trying to break even and set targets. You have to know why you're setting targets. And if we're looking at a technical chart and you go back and look, and like, now we're back up to last May highs. We made some good sales in cash sales last spring. every one of our cash sales we've made now since May is at or above what we sold it at. And we thought we did a wonderful job in marketing. But you look at the price of grain, and anybody that hedged grain last May and June has got a margin call. Isn't that interesting? So you ask yourself, why is that going? That should have never happened if we're all so smart, you know. We shouldn't have to be dealing with that. At some point in time, we're going to turn around, but I think the funds will stay long a lot longer than what we think. And then now we start watching that, and eventually, like some people say, the door is not going to be wide enough for the market to let everybody out at the same time. But if you do due diligence and watch the signals that worked for the last 40 years, then you understand when that happens, yeah, I may not want to be long the market on paper. And if I'm long in the bend, maybe it's time to start selling something. And when we get that action, we will do that. Like we sense the bottom, we'll also be able to sense the top within probably 2 or 3 weeks before the market actually turns south. And we've got the spring to go through yet, you know, and any kind of weather. Think what happens in May if it's too wet to get the crop in for some reason, or we get a hot spell in July, and we're sitting here with a carryover of 1.45, we'll say, carry in to next year. It makes next year's yield awful, awful important.
So you talked a little bit about the moving averages. What do you follow in moving averages? I tend to have the 20, the 50, the 100, and the 200 up. What do you follow?
Well, I'll tell you what. I've listened to all that, and some of my guys will look at it and say, well, you know, we haven't been above the 200-day moving average for a long time. Well, what happened when you went above the 20-day moving average? I use the 3, 5, and 9 on a daily basis. When the 3 and the 5 cross the 9, if I'm short grain, or maybe I'm speculating or got a hedge, I'll probably get out for a day and see what happens. It's managing that risk, or get out of some. If I'm short 40%, I'll probably take 10% off or something. But that 3, 5, and 9, pretty soon I'm listening to guys, well, you know, a 25-day moving average and a 50-day moving average. All of a sudden, I've watched the market go up to almost a 200-day average, and I'm still short, and all these averages have been blown right on through. And now I'm at one that, now what do I do? I've got a margin call of 40 cents, and now I'm at the 200-day average. About the time I'm so disgusted that I don't even want to look at a hedge anymore. I want to get rid of it and get it out of sight, you know, even if it's wrong, and I buy the top. That's the emotional part that comes in. So I make a decision much sooner than what the majority of guys out there who I will say never.
Because you're following shorter, much shorter.
And shorter. Yeah. And then
Like overnight tonight, we're half a cent from the 50 moving across the 200.
Yeah. Today.
Just a half cent short of that. And it'll probably go through that tonight. I can't imagine that wouldn't be the case. Or it could bounce.
Well, either that or on the Farm Forum. What's that going to tell us next week? You know, are they going to see as many acres as some people think? There's, you know, I think FC Stone is thinking it could be as high as, wouldn't be surprised it'd be 4.5. Maybe they're 2.5. I think Pro Farmer's thinking a little over 2 million acres. We're doing our crop survey, and we don't have a lot in yet because we just started it. And I'm looking at it, and I am shocked at how many people in Illinois and Iowa are pretty happy with the rotation. You know, I'm going to stay with the rotation. And if corn goes up, it'll probably drag beans up with it too. And you know, we get into that, not rut, but we get into that where it works good for us. Is a 10,000 acre farmer that's raising 50-50, is he going to jump an extra 5,000 acres and go to 100% corn? You know, maybe some might, but boy, that is a, come harvest, they better be ready for that. So you just don't move that much. We were kind of looking for something that if we could see a 5% increase in corn acres by everybody, whether they're farming 1,000 acres or 5,000 or 15,000 acres, then that tells you that the general sentiment is kind of that wave is, and we've seen that before a couple times in the last 40 years. And when you see that, it's pretty easy to predict that, well, 5% of 80 million is 4 million. There you go. It could be 7% more. And but to get a 5 million acre switch or 4.5 million and a good yield, it may be what's needed in order to assure that you don't run into a runaway market in the summer if it gets hot. So we look at that, and what I've watched for the first time, and I noticed it this morning, and we had a conference call, and I said, did you notice that our buy and sell signals? I call them buy and sell signals. It's nothing more than that. But we had sell signals in July corn a while back. I want to say 2 weeks ago, when things kind of petered out, and the momentum kind of stopped going up, and things kind of felt negative and so forth. And we had a trigger point. And while that technical system was negative, corn prices went up 18 cents a bushel. It's rare that we ever see that. And I recall from the old days thinking, if the market doesn't go your way when you have a technical signal or whatever you use as a trigger point to say, I've got to do something, even sell a semi-load just to see if I'm right, and it doesn't work, it may be not working this time. And I went back and looked, and I'll be doggone if soybeans didn't back off a little bit, and it's been the kind of negative, and I'm thinking, well, this might be it, because everybody knows the big crop in South America. Lo and behold, that Tucker didn't go, we didn't get a 5 or a 10% correction or a 40 or 50 cent correction. We barely had enough room for somebody who was looking to get back in the market. He didn't have a lot of time to get into corn. It wasn't much of a pullback. And now we're getting to the point where it's almost going along again, right at the point where there's no reason, fundamental reason in the world that we know of right now that tells us that we ought to be owning $10.70 corn, soybeans. That's asinine. And yet, here we are. And we got a farm forum coming up. What are they going to say at 7 o'clock in the morning one day and saying, you know, we don't see much of a change. Holy cow. Then corn could get pretty exciting, and that'll drag beans up with it probably.
What technical targets do you have for new crop December corn at the moment? I'm assuming 490, which is resistance kind of level. But if you go through there, $5 is easy. There's a gap back a day in the daily chart in January of last year. That's around 518 or so. But where are you putting your targets?
Well, I will use my system that tells me when to go short when the time comes. I don't have a target, but I know brokers and people that have some technical knowledge but no fundamental knowledge will look at that and say, well, it was here before. And I look at that, and I'll ask you the question, what was the fundamental situation back when that we had that gap, or when we had resistance at $5 before? What was the fundamental reason that caused corn, we'll say, not to go any higher? And that there was a fundamental reason, and last May it was because we were talking about a 2.1 carryover or more back in May. Okay, now, are we talking the same, is the same fundamentals today existing that says $5 is high enough? Knowing what you know today, has there been any changes? And you can say, oh yeah, Jerry, the target carryover that we were looking at a year ago in May, or 3 months from now, be a year, was much greater than what we're seeing now. So what value in April and May and June do I have to discover on the Board of Trade, we'll say, such that I can ensure that we'll get enough acres planted such that my carryover will be 2.1 or 2.2 billion bushels next fall, and I don't have to worry about feeding my cattle $5 corn or $6 corn or whatever. So and so whatever happened a year ago is just a dot in the chart. And when we had that January 12th crop report in January, and that changed the world, a lot of people were surprised by that. We weren't, because we've been talking about the NASS had overstated the stocks for ever since last March by about 700 million. They finally come back to, got religion and got it back by hook or by crook by raising exports and obvious things. So the fundamental outlook going forward from here is almost totally different than what it was the last time you were at $5 and had a gap to fill. So I made statements to my guys that were watching. I says, anything that happened prior to January 11th when that report came out, to be direct, I said, you throw it out the window. It means nothing to us anymore. The world changed on January 11th because it was a shock, and the government's trying to put in more demand than what most people think is going to be there, because they're predicting the future based on the past. And of course, that's pretty radical to say that. But sometimes you gotta hit somebody over the head with a glove or something to get them to notice, to say, what changed? The whole world changed in January.
That tells me that you look back and you say, well, those highs, and I think this is hard for farmers to get hold of.
Yeah.
Those highs from last year when we were looking at 2.2 billion bushels in a carryout, They mean very little going forward when we have a 1.5 billion bushel carryout. You can't compare one to the other based because that high was coming off a really high high.
Really high high.
Our supply and demand were not in balance. Today, the 10% tells you maybe they are in balance, but there's something that the marketplace sees.
Yeah.
And that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
And is driving this market higher.
Yeah. And we will see it fulfilling. And that's why they always say bull market needs good news every day. We hear that coming through, whether it's the Thailand thing. And even some of your guests this past week have mentioned the fact, you know, why, and you've asked excellent questions about why are we at where we're at? Well, it could be because maybe the crop isn't as good in Argentina as we think, and it keeps coming down a little bit. And it could be that maybe there's some buying out there. And exports have been strong. They're 20% better than we were last year, which was 20% better than the year before. We're on a trend, and they've even heard the words, and we're doing this without China buying corn from us. What would happen if they bought a little corn and Trump and China made nice? Or they fulfilled their $50 billion that Biden didn't force them to take, and they now say, you know, you're going to fill that, otherwise you're not getting TikTok back or whatever. We're starting to hear those reasons of why something should happen and why it could go forward when none of those things were even a figment of imagination 6 months ago. And yet the market was pointing that the low is over and we're gonna march higher right on through into December and January, even in spite of farmers selling. And we kept hearing, and I kept calling elevators, and you did too, and you mentioned it. There'd been a massive amount of farmers selling. You know, there's semis lined up, yet the market blew right through it. That's quite a bit different, and our base is a little wider, but this time of the year, elevators like to steal the grain anyway. So, but at any rate, when we see all that farmer selling, it transfers it from the weak hands, which if you talk to a big speculator, he says, you know, I don't want to buy any grain if Jerry and his friends are holding 80% of the crop, because I don't know when Jerry's going to say, you know, you need to sell some grain here, and all of a sudden they sell 20% of their crop. I can't handle a billion bushels of grain sold any one year. I'll buy that grain to sell later at a higher price once Jerry and his friends have washed out of it and it's in ADM, Cargill, and Dreyfus, and whomever, elevator's hands. They buy grain to sell for a profit. We grow grain to sell for a profit. But you never know when all of us are going to get together on one accord and say, I don't care what anybody says, sell 30% of next year's crop. The market can't handle that in one day. You get it done, and then they will buy it. Then it's in strong hands. And a speculator says, I know what ADM and Cargill are going to do. If they're going to find a importer that wants to pay more than what they paid for it. And sometimes they get burnt doing that in a down market. But the other thing, we're probably running out of time, is that this thing about CFTC and the large specs, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Board of Trade or the price discovery system as we know it, is a net sum zero game. All day long, it's like playing poker. At the end of the day, you buy and I sell, and I may sell something.
Every buyer has to have a seller. Yes,
yeah,
I know.
So the question that you ask yourselves and people that you have on air that talk about it are worried about the speculator selling one day. When they bought that grain, somebody had to sell it to them, and it was a farmer that probably sold it to them, or an elevator that sold hedges or whatever, hedged some stuff off. So somebody had to buy it. Now, when he gets his belly full and he sees the end of time coming for them, they will slowly start to get out of it. And that's when you watch the CFTC reports and say, what has he done? Every other week, he'll probably buy a long week. I think I think we're going to find out the last 3 or 4 days, they added to their long positions again. The index fund, as I heard today, bought another 35,000 contracts of corn. So if they're buying, somebody's selling it to them, and we're chewing right on through all the farmer selling that we could possibly muster. And I don't know how much corn we got left in farmers' hands, but I doubt that it's much more than 15% of last year's crop. And the ones that aren't selling, they're pretty well healed if they haven't sold it by now. So that's something that nobody talks about, is that is that for every buyer there's a seller, and that's I look at it and say, why am I lined up at the elevator dumping my grain, and this guy's out buying it and he never grew a crop in his life? What does he know that I don't know? He's speculating, but he's speculating in a big way, and that's reason for concern, reason to reevaluate what we're thinking along the way. And once in a number of years this happens like this, and bull markets are very hard to handle. It is very difficult to talk somebody into who has sold their grain perhaps and what they thought was a great deal. And now I say, you know, you need to buy some $4.80 corn, because here's the reason why, the technical reasons I can tout perhaps. Yeah, that's all witchcraft. That's blue sky stuff. But yet that's nothing more than a pictorial representation of what money is doing. And it boils down to that price discovery system that says at the end of the day, we all vote and we find out who won or lost. And when the prices keep going up consistently day after day after day, and what I watch is weekly closes. I want to see a new high for the week, perhaps, but certainly new high closer for the week. And if not by a big amount, certainly not very much lower than the previous week to sustain that rally. And we've seen that right along. And that's, you know, that's more than you ever wanted to know about marketing. It gets too complicated. I did an article on DTN. I read where they took a poll again. Only 11% of the producers use futures and options. So we've transferred our risk management over to RMA and crop insurance. And Jamie, my son-in-law that works with me, sells crop insurance. And you can buy enough crop insurance now, and I've seen guys do it that farm 10, 12, 14,000 acres. You buy enough crop insurance and want to spend $40 or $45 an acre, you won't lose. So we've transferred that whole system to risk management. And 20 years ago, I gave a seminar to RMA at the forum in Washington, D.C. about risk management. My risk management was like you and I talked about letting the market tell you what's going to happen. They wanted to hear something about crop insurance. And I didn't present that. And to me, that wasn't risk management. Crop insurance, God, if Musk gets a hold of that, he's going to look at it and say, who in the world allowed this to happen? I can't sell every car that I produce at a profit. No matter if I say, all right, I'll buy insurance and I lock in at 80% of my gross, I'm still going to make money. I'll produce every car I can possibly make and sell it. If I can't sell it to Todd and Jerry, I'll sell it to the government and they'll pay me. Nobody else has this kind of a deal in hand.
Yeah, the problem with that, Jerry, of course, going away, is that risk is tied up in the capital expenses within the land.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it has a enormous impact on the tax base for local school districts.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And local fire departments, and it disappears so fast, and the economy just... The rural economy is tied up in the value of farmland.
Oh, yeah. I know full well. We own a lot of land in North Dakota, and when they decided to build a whole new school district, whole new school building, torn down good ones and put up new ones, they said, nobody's going to come to live in Allendale, North Dakota if we don't have a school system. It took 40 years for that to happen. And who paid for that school? The farmer that owned the land, because the land prices, land taxes went up, and that helped. They know where to get the money from. And one other thing that I'm looking at that's maybe piqued somebody's interest, and I was around when Reagan was in office, and I remember the worst recession in my lifetime was after he decided to free the market up to free enterprise, and he pulled the rug out from under me and my payment limitations and so forth. I went from $200,000 to $50,000 a year, and there was a day of reckoning for me. I mean, that was a lot of people went broke in the 80s, as you know. And of course, we had higher interest rates, but we had $3,000 an acre land, not $15,000 an acre land. So it may be close, but I remember that happening under a cost cutting type of thing that we're seeing, and with Trump trying to rectify a problem. I remember the results, and so I went back and looked and studied the 1930s, and I said, you know, what was it about the marketplace? The market gurus like we would have on TV now, CNBC or Bloomberg and stuff, anybody that owns stocks thinks it's a wonderful economy. And I said, what was it that missed that they missed that stock market crash, and so many guys lost everything. And the bottom line was the conclusion of the researchers that I found said the big failure was that they failed to recognize the plight of the middle class and common man. They didn't realize how bad it was on Main Street once they got away from New York, Wall Street, and other places. And lo and behold, today on CNBC, one of the guys I listened to, the young guy, I forgot his name, and he announced that for 8 years he's been researching the stock market crash of 1929, and he's going to put out a book in October of all times. And he said he's looked at memos, he's looked at letters between people in the stock market, what they were saying, and analyzing the marketplace and the future. You know, my parents grew up on that, and they were dancing in the good times. They were having a great time, and he said it is uncanny. He said is how similar it is today than what it was in 1929, and I've sent chills down my back because I've been preaching that to the guys. I said, I don't know as the people in the stock market and in the index funds and those people that have a lot of money in the stock market. I have friends in California, couldn't be happier. Their common theme is that if Trump would be president now, he'd say, how could you get it any better? Look at the stock market. Look at my equity. Look at my housing. Everything that we bought. And if you look at somebody that's, we'll say, under 55 or under 50, they haven't had a bad day in their life. They've graduated from school. It's been pretty decent all the way up, and they don't know what hard times are. So if we're going to reset the economy, I'm a little concerned that the guys that know how to do this are old guys yet. And a lot of these guys that are in office, the way they curbed inflation in the 70s was you get unemployment higher, and then you get labor down. And I don't know if we can do that any longer. So I'm watching it like a hawk. If I get sell signals in the stock market, I'm out of here. My 401ks will go to cash. And if you look at the stock market, take a look, close look at it. I think for the last 4 months, and you talk about new highs, well, new highs for the move or new highs for the recent move, but we've been 4 months trying to break out to the upside. If we do it in March, be careful that we don't take out the previous month's lows, that we make a reversal in the previous month's lows. That'll probably give us the first sell signal we've had for a long time. And then it says be wary, because we'll find out probably in the next 30 days just how well this new administration is going to do.
On that note, thank you very much. You said we could probably talk a half hour. We talked 45 minutes. I appreciate it, Jerry.
Oh, boy. That's I'm okay. Sorry. You can pick it up.
No. We'll use it all on, not maybe on the radio, but we'll use it all in the podcast. Thank you so much, Jerry, for taking the time with us.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Thanks again. Yep. Bye-bye.
Jerry Gulke, of course, is with the Gulke Group. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.